All right, good morning, members. I call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We are holding this remote hearing pursuant to House Rule 10.01. I have been notified that a quorum is present. Anna, will you please take the roll?
Chair Becker Finn. Representative Mueller.
Here.
Representative
Scott. Here.
Representative
Becker Finn present.
Becker Finn present. Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative Farr. Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
All right, thank you. A quorum is present. Today, members, we're going to be hearing 8 bills. And before we do that, we need approval of the minutes of March 16, 2021. Representative Scott, would you move those minutes?
I'd be happy to move those minutes, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Any comments on the minutes for March 16, 2021? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 The motion prevails and the minutes for March 16th are approved. Next, members, before we get into the bills, we are going to discuss Representative Bang's bill, House File 717. We had a full bill presentation before on this, but at the time we were waiting for a fiscal note, so we had laid it over. The fiscal note has since come back with zero cost, so we have noticed the bill for final action today. Representative Bang, would you like to move that House File 717 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 717 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Thank you, Representative Bang. So, members, we now have the bill before us again, but we do have some amendments. Before we get to those, Representative Johnson, I see that your hand is up.
Well, if we have some amendments, we can take care of them first.
Okay, very well. So, Representative Vang, the bill is before us again. The first amendment that we have before us is the A1 amendment, and Representative Scott, I believe that that is your amendment, and if so, would you like to move that?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the A1.
Okay, great. Do you want to tell us what the A1 amendment does?
Sure. What the A1 does is it just, current law says that the statute of limitations on the crime that we're looking at today is 3 years, and this would just double it to 6, which is in alignment with other areas of statute for similar offenses. And I just think to have zero a statute of limitations on crimes like this, people's memories fade, witnesses die or you can't find them. And I just think that there needs to be a date certain that gives the victims and the plaintiffs plenty of time to gather the evidence that they need, but also just doesn't extend it for the life of this offense. So that's my amendment, Madam Chair, and I'd ask for member support.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Bang, would you like to comment on the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for your amendment. However, the nature of the bill is, the intent of the bill is to eliminate the statute of limitations. The testifiers have mentioned problems with the statute of limitations being too short of a time for them, mainly because, investigations can be stalled. And before any rational lawyers take up a case, they would like to look into the details. So the 6 years is too short of a time for them. So I will recommend members to vote no to this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Vang. I don't see any other hands up, but I'll just pause for a minute. Is there any further discussion on this amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Members, the next amendment is amendment number 5, and I believe that there's also an A6. So, Representative Novotny, I understand that those are your amendments. And so, first, would you like to move the A5 amendment?
Madam Chair, that is up to you. I can address them at the same time or do them individually.
Let's move both amendments first. So, if you would move the A5 amendment, so that's before us.
I so move.
Okay, great. And now we'll also move the A6 amendment if that's what you wish to do.
That is fine, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Fantastic. And it's my understanding that the A6 amendment gets the A5 in the shape that you desire. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So any discussion on the A6? Oh, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if we could roll call these amendments, please. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Scott, did you want to roll call the A6 also? It's just putting the bill in the shape the author desires.
I mean, if you adopt the one and then on final passage of the bill as amended, I'd like to roll call that. Thanks.
You're asking for, if we adopt the A6, the A5 to be roll called.
Madam Chair, I'd like both.
Yeah. Okay. Very well. Okay, great. Representative Liebling, your hand is up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wonder if we could have some explanation, brief, of what these things are before we vote on them.
Okay, sure. So we were just going to go to the A6 first, which puts the A5 in the shape the author desires. So Representative Novotny, do you want to just briefly, I guess, go ahead and explain the A5 and then what the A6 does?
DA5 expands the categories of persons that would be affected by this reduction or the elimination of the statute's limitations. As I found out in testimony from a person on Tuesday, all you need to do to do for research is do a Google search and find out, you know, articles that are available on Google. So using that information, I did research and I found out that persons in positions of authority have used their positions to hide investigations and keep witnesses from coming forward. If we look at the United States gymnastics scandal involving a doctor, if we look at multiple cases of college coaches using their influence to manipulate people into sexual situations where they are using their coercion to use that as a way of getting what they want. Any person of, if you have kids and they're in club sports, even when those kids get older, you understand how much manipulation or influence a coach or someone from the organization, as we've had in previous testimony here on different bills, has over a person, including the parents, that could be manipulated to get favored position or college positions for their children. So I think any person in a position of authority should be included in this. And I think it's a good move for everyone to have this in mind.
Okay, thank you. And can you just tell us what the A6 amendment does?
The A6 amendment brings in also legislators. It wasn't included. And once I started realizing, once again, with the Google search on how many times legislators have used their influence, let's face it, members of this committee last year passed a almost $2 billion bonding bill. Our total budget is, in the $55 to $56 billion range. We make decisions and we pass laws that affect everyone's life. I look at the current bill that several of the members of this sitting committee right now that have signed on to, 259, which would make people less than if we look at the other provision, section 2 of the provisions of this bill in wrongful death, we have people that are, well, for example, in 2019, by Minnesota statutes. Our Minnesota records, 9,922 abortions were completed in the state of Minnesota, over half of which is very much out of line with the general population, were Black people, Indigenous, or persons of color.
Representative Nivati, so I just admit
those are matters of wrongful death, and these are decisions that we
Representative Nivati.
Yes, ma'am.
I was just asking for an explanation of the A6, which I believe that you have given us already.
Thank you.
Yep, and I'd like to move on the A6. Before we move on the A6, Representative Liebling, did you have your comment? Your hand was up.
Madam Chair, I actually hadn't intended to leave my hand up, but I would just say, given that boy, this is just a political stunt. This is really appalling. That's all I'm going to say. Thank you.
Okay, so Representative Vang, did you want to comment on the A6? We'll have a discussion about the A5, but can you comment on the A6?
Madam Chair, since the A6 is just amending the A5 amendment, we could just, I'll reserve my comments for that when we move, when the A5 is amended to the shape that Representative Navani wants.
Okay, thank you. And I see Representative Grossel, your hand is up again. Is this to the A6, Representative Grossel?
Sorry, a bit rusty. Got to get back into the swing of things. Yeah, to the A6. And it seems that if we're going to be extending the statute of limitations on one group, then you better make it a lot of them. And Representative Liebling is correct. It is appalling that a lot of these things are not being addressed. We have a lot of good legislation out there. The way this one is set up, this is not one of them. But the A6 and the A5 will make it a better piece of legislation. Because if we're going to hold one group accountable, the rest of them better fall in line as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so the A6 is before us right now, and a roll call has been requested on the A6. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Fard.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Chong.
Aye.
Chair Becker Finn. There are 16 ayes and no nays.
All right, the A6 amendment is adopted, and now we can discuss the A5 amendment as amended. Representative Novotny has already given us an explanation of what the amendment does. Representative Fang, would you like to comment on the A5?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Novotny, for your amendment. It sounds like a good idea. However, I've taken a look at the amendment and it doesn't seem quite ready yet. I also don't feel comfortable expanding the scope of the bill when we haven't engaged with these new stakeholders and we don't have, the time for it really to expand the bill and go through the stakeholder engagement process. And so with that, I recommend members a no vote to the A5 as amended.
Thank you, Representative Vang. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question to the bill's author, Representative Vang. Speaking of stakeholders, did you reach out to the law enforcement community when you drafted this bill? Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Vang.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, and Representative Scott, just a reminder, we have had a full discussion of this bill already, and we are discussing the amendment at this point. Any follow-up.
No, my only follow-up would have been, were they in support of this bill?
All right. Let's see here. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Vang. I support this amendment because just, I think it was last week, maybe it was this week because I can't remember, but we extended the mandatory reporting to all these different groups where people are in position of authority over children and had, you know, really compelling testimony by Zander and some other folks who had been affected by these different groups. And so I feel like this is sort of the flip side of the coin. So I urge members to support that because we have been working on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robinson. I guess I have a question for House research staff. Maybe Ms. Mullins can answer this. I know years ago the legislature already expanded the statute of limitations for sexual assault crimes. So I believe that a lot of those situations that Representative Novotny covered in his amendment are already covered. And so if Ms. Mullins, if you could just briefly describe what the law currently does with respect to minors, that would be helpful.
Chair and members of the committee, the bill, the current law made it so that when a minor was going to sue somebody who had sexually assaulted them when they were under the age of 18, that they could sue at any time, except it created a limit of 6 years after they turn 18 for a very specific kind of lawsuit, which is respondent superior or sort of a stricter liability towards schools or churches.
Thank you, Ms. Mullins. That is helpful. So just so I'm clear, the law currently already covers minors, except for that one situation where there's 6 years. There is no statute of limitation?
That's correct, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to follow up with Representative Scott's question that you asked about the law enforcement community. Have they been addressed? Have they been consulted in this, and what is their support for it?
Representative Grossel, again, we are discussing the amendment. I will let Representative Vang answer this question, but then we are going to keep on discussing the amendment. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just remind members that this bill has been discussed with relevant stakeholders. The earlier version had concerns from law enforcement because it was too open-ended. And so this bill narrows that and to address some of those concerns. So it has been addressed.
That doesn't answer my question. I'm sorry.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After Ms. Mullins' reply, I just had a quick follow-up, if you'll allow that.
Go ahead, Representative Robbins.
Thank you. So, Ms. Mullins, if you could just clarify for me, the six-year limitation applies to people in authority who are from schools, and what was the other institution?
Ms. Mullins.
Chair and members, the other institution I mentioned is churches. There were a lot of cases after the law was passed related to churches.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. So currently there is a six-year statute of limitation on school authorities and church authorities, and this amendment would make it unlimited. Am I understanding that correctly?
No, that's not correct. Sorry, this is a very specific type of case. You can sue an individual who harmed you. There is no statute of limitations on that to the individual person.
Representative Robbins.
For a minor. Does that make sense?
Representative Robbins.
I'm not sure, but I guess I'm wondering, so once the minor who has no statute of limitations becomes 18, then the statute of limitations kicks in?
Ms. Mullins.
Chair and members, sorry. The nature of the case when the lawsuit is filed against an individual is different when the lawsuit is filed against an organization based on a vicarious liability. So it's two different types of lawsuit.
Yes.
And the statute of limitations is different for each.
Okay. Very helpful. Sorry to take up your time. Thank you.
Okay. I agree. That was really helpful information. Thank you so much, Ms. Mullins. A roll call has been requested on the A5 amendment as amended. The clerk will take the roll.
Could I just comment, please?
Yep, go ahead, Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. In response to this bill, my point of the amendments is that we make decisions that affect people's lives and can affect decisions, although not directly, but can have long-term effects by the decision that we make as legislators and in other positions that we have. I have concerns with this bill. Just the definitions are vague. Death caused by peace officer, for example. What does that mean? I did some back of the napkin.
Representative Novotny, I just want to remind you, we're talking about your amendment right now, not the bill. So if you could keep your comments to the amendment, please.
I'll do my best, ma'am, or Madam Chair. No, I'll save them for the floor decision. I feel that make rules that you're willing to live by yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. The clerk will take the roll on the A5 amendment as amended.
Chair Becker Finn. Representative Mueller?
No.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Frazier?
No.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
No.
Representative Zhang?
No.
Chair Becker Finn? Okay. There are 7 ayes and 9 nays.
There being 7 ayes and 9 nays, the amendment is not adopted. And now we are back to the bill. Representative Vang has her bill before us again. Remember that we've already had a full discussion of this. We've even had some discussion right now about the bill, talking about the amendment. Representative Johnson.
Chair members, I'm going to speak against this bill. If the amendment would have gone on, it would have been better. As legislatures, we should not force anybody to do anything we would not. Now, law enforcement, they do their best to weed out the bad players. They do everything they can, if there is a bad officer, to get them off the streets and hold them accountable. I know a number of officers that have been charged with these situations, and they have lost their jobs, and they have gone to prison. Now, we had tried to add legislators, and I wish I would have even gone farther. We have a situation right now in New York. The governor of New York is being, and the way it looks like, we only see one side of the story, just like the situation here in Minnesota. Looks like he's guilty, and not just of sexual harassment, actual sexual abuse. And seeing the time limits on that, if they were in Minnesota, the victims would have no recourse. And this is the governor.
Representative Johnson, Representative Johnson, please keep your comments to the bill in front of us. Again, as a reminder that we've already had a full discussion of this bill. We have a number of bills before us today. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I had my hand up during this bill. I was not given an opportunity to speak when we had it last time. This is a serious issue. Now, we have a situation where we wanted to extend it to 6 years, which had been plenty of time. Right now, we're seeing what happens when these settlements are done too early. We're looking at a change of venue we will have an announcement tomorrow on a change of venue in a trial that's happening in Minnesota right now in Minneapolis, because a settlement was announced when the trial was
started. Again, Representative Johnson, this is one last chance here. Otherwise, we're going to move on to other members. We are talking about the bill in front of us, which we've already had an opportunity to discuss. Go ahead.
This is important. I have a right to speak what I need to speak about on this bill. This deals with this bill and how improper this bill is. It's targeting law enforcement officers when we have members of legislators across the state or across the country that's doing these things. We have governors that are doing these things, and we're not talking about them. We had an opportunity to fix that, and this committee said no. We have an issue where unlimited time period when people die, witnesses die, that people can no longer get the witnesses to defend themselves. I think 6 years would have been plenty of time. And with that, I cannot support this bill at this time.
Okay, members, Representative Becker Finn is back with us, so I'm turning the gavel back over to her.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mohler. And we will get to Representative Grossel, but I will note even just since I joined the room, I just remind members that we're speaking briefly to the underlying bill. We've already had committee discussion and testimony on this bill, so please try to stay focused. Thank you. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'll go back to the bill. I'll go back to my question that was not satisfied with the answer, because from what I'm understanding is that you do not have a representative, and you do not have law enforcement support on this. You said you tried to address some of the issues, but you do not have law enforcement support on this bill. And I can see why. I mean, how far, you know, this bill says it's retroactive. How far back does that reach? How far back does that reach, Representative? Sorry.
Representative Vang.
Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, there's a five-year look-back window.
Five-year look-back window. Okay.
Representative Grossel.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at this as well, you know, Madam Chair and committee, I'm seeing a lot of legislation coming forward that specifically targeting our law enforcement officers. And, you know, I just look at what has gone on in the past year as far as the community screaming for help, needing help. But this type of legislation does nothing but hamstring an officer's ability to be able to do their job and perform it safely, professionally, and make sure that our citizens are protected. You know, I have to go back to, I was involved in an officer-involved shooting. I was shot in the line of duty. Drug dealer decided he wanted to kill me one morning. And fortunately, my partner and I were able to survive that. Unfortunately, the drug dealer did not. So decisions have to be made in a split second. When you have a .38 revolver 2 inches from the bridge of your nose, bad things come after that. And that was from a disgruntled customer in a hotel lobby. This person was set mad up. So to leave a door that wide open for decisions that have to be made in a split second. And I guess, you know, I'm looking at some of the stuff where it says one of the concerns was that these cases are being strung out. I don't know of any of these cases or any attorneys or any representation whatsoever who has strung something out past the statute of limitations in these types of cases.
Because we already took testimony, you know, we don't have additional testimony today. So we're going to move on to Representative
Madam Chair, Baker. Madam Chair, this is hanging our law enforcement officers out in the dang wind.
And you're entitled to your opinion, Representative Grossel, and nobody's making you vote for it. But we've fully discussed and had testimony on this bill, and we're going to move forward. Representative Frazier, real quick, and then closing words from Representative Novotny.
I'll try to go as quick as I can. I'm hearing this conversation, and I'm just thinking about the moment that this state is in right now. The world is watching. And we are trying to take steps to fix some things that are very broken, that are harming communities in a disproportionate manner. And they have been harming communities in a disproportionate manner for years, decades. The laws that we have on the book now, I'm hearing this both sides of the argument piece, and everybody's got to be held accountable. Right now, murder and manslaughter, there is no statute of limitations. So if someone does that in a community, they will be held accountable, but there will be due process. This bill does not take away due process. It allows for an opportunity to fix some things that are very broken, that are very harmful. We need to keep that in mind. The world is watching. But oftentimes in these conversations, it sounds like the world is not watching, and we're okay with maintaining the status quo and not fixing these things. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Real quick, Representative Novotny, and then Representative Vang.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Frazier kind of changed my change of thought on that. And Representative Frazier, I feel you're making the point of our point. The world is watching because the trial is taking place as we speak within a year of the incident. The civil part is already settled. And they are watching. So
Representative,
what are we attempting to fix?
I'll just remind you that this bill is not a George Floyd bill. If you remember, and this is part of why we weren't going to get into full committee discussion, because if folks remember, we had very moving testimony from the family members of folks who have not been able to have their day in court and have not had access to those the evidence in their cases. So real quick, Representative Ani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's hard to, I'll save it for the floor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Novotny, Representative Vang, and then we'll move to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I won't take any more time. This is a good bill, and for members who feel they can't support this bill, I'm happy to continue the talks. Thank you.
All right. The clerk will. You'll have to remind me whose motion it was. Representative Vang renews her motion to move this bill to the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Hur.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Fang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
There are 10 ayes and 7 nays.
With that, the motion prevails and House File 717 is recommended to be placed on the general register. With that, members, we'll move on to the next bill. It's a Representative Lislegarde bill, House File 984. Representative Lislegarde, welcome to our committee. I will remind folks that we are limiting the discussion to the provisions within our jurisdiction, which would be Section 2, Subdivisions 3 and 4. I will move that House File 984 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Lislegarde, your bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. We're in front of you today to discuss portions of House File 984 related to this committee's jurisdiction. As such, I plan to keep my comments limited due to the respect of your time. House File 984 is a bill intended to protect the safety of workers in hazardous facilities, specifically oil refineries, and also to protect the surrounding communities. This bill requires that at least 85% of the employees of any contractor working at an oil refinery have the experience with registered apprenticeship program in the appropriate trade. The bill also lays out fines for violation of this and allows contractors to be held accountable to this standard. The previous hearings we've had explored the policy implications of this bill, and I won't rehash those conversations. I will say, however, that this bill is not intended to be union versus non-union. This bill is not about interfering with the private sector of business. What this bill is about doing the right thing and ensuring that contractors are providing the training oversight that is critical to ensuring the safety of these facilities, workers, and the surrounding communities. This isn't a new concept. As the state, we have repeatedly said that having training and oversight is important. It is critical industries like those in my district and major construction projects like the Viking Stadium that required this. I just want to share that the background of this bill, I thank the committee for dedicating time to consider this. And with that, I will turn it over to Brandon Cummins, who will walk through the portions of the bill that directly relate to this committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lislegarde. Mr. Cummins, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brendan Cummins, attorney for the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. Each of the provisions we're talking about today contains a customary method of enforcing Minnesota workplace laws. It's common for enforcement to involve a combination of agency action and private lawsuits. Subdivision 3 provides for civil penalties to be imposed by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. This is similar to other civil penalties that may be imposed by the Commissioner for violations of workplace laws. One similar example is for record-keeping violations under Minnesota Statutes Section 177.30. The amount of the penalty ranges between $5,000 and $10,000. The commissioner would have discretion to decide the appropriate amount based on the size of the violator's business and the seriousness of the violation. Each shift on which a violation would occur would be considered a separate violation. And this is consistent with how Minnesota courts have interpreted other civil penalty provisions. Subdivision 4 provides for private lawsuits for damages to enforce the act. The language is similar to the private lawsuit provision in Minnesota Statute Section 181.721, which allows bidders to sue when they lose work to a contractor that violates workers' compensation and unemployment laws. Workplace laws commonly provide for enforcement by private lawsuits. House research staff has made some helpful technical suggestions to clarify this language, but my understanding is these changes would not alter the intent. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll move to member discussion. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess this would be a question for either the bill author or the gentleman that just spoke. These violations, if somebody doesn't get a contract, can they sue the the refinery just because they didn't get the contract, so they're going to sue for the money that they could have made? Am I understanding that correctly?
Representative Grossel, I'll remind you, I think he was using that as a similar to type of provision, but this bill does not have those provisions in it. Mr. Cummins.
That was a question for them, Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
Yes, so that could be a scenario that would result in a lawsuit if an oil refinery hired a contractor without requiring compliance with this provision. A disappointed bidder who, in fact, submitted a compliant bid could sue for lost profits. And that is a standard measure of damages in these types of scenarios.
Representative Grossel, remembering that the bill in front of us is regarding outside contractors and having the correct amount of training.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm looking at that, and knowing where my colleague is from, are any of these kind of is any kind of legislation like this or been presented as far as the mining industry, Representative Lislegarde?
Representative Lislegarde.
Madam Chair and Representative Grossel, I can't speak to specifically. I do know that union contractors that have the apprenticeship programs and then full journeymen work in the mines. So you do not go and run a crane if you do not have, you're not a certified crane operator. If you do not meet that threshold, you do not work at these facilities.
And I think, Madam Chair.
Follow up, Representative Grossel.
And from what I've learned about the oil industry, Representative Lislegarde, is that they have pretty stringent rules on who does what where as well, especially in Minnesota. So I look at this and I'm thinking, man, I'd like to support you. But it's if you're not going to look in your own backyard for things, then you shouldn't be going after other people's livelihoods.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Lislegarde. On this bill, dealing with the lawsuits and stuff like that, does this involve all the trades and any work being done within the facility?
Representative Lislegarde.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I do believe so. Only outside contractors. It does not affect the workers inside the facility.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Lislegarde. I understand why you're doing it for those working on the pipes and the high sensitive areas, but the way the bill is written, it would affect somebody coming in to paint an office. It affects somebody coming in to install phones, radio equipment, even some safety devices, the smoke detectors and stuff like that. I think this bill needs to go back and be reworked, get set up properly. So I have concerns about this because, and also even with the apprentice programs in the that are there for these trades, I've talked to some of the construction trades trainers. They're in dire need. Right now, we don't have the people to do the work. 8 years ago, they were begging people that were retired to come back to work to fulfill the jobs they have. We've had such a push to put people through college that we don't have people going into the construction trades anymore. I think we need to look at, and I want people to have these jobs. I want them well-trained, and the apprentice program is a good one. But right now, the apprentice program and the construction trades are in dire straits with the number of employees they have. Do we want highly trained personnel in there? Absolutely. But you can have highly trained without going through an apprentice program through some of the technical colleges that we have as well. And I think this could actually limit who could actually do the work. And
Representative Johnson, I'll just remind you that the question before us is whether there should be a civil action and what those penalties should be.
I understand that, Chair McGriffin. But if we don't have the employees, it's going to start limiting who can actually do the work there. And I think that's even worse because competition helps keep the cost down. We've seen in the last, three months, and we've seen gas prices go up almost 40%. So with that alone, I'd love to support this bill, but the current way it's written, I cannot support it.
All right, Representative Robbins, and then we'll go to the vote. And Representative Robbins, you're usually pretty good at this, but I'll just remind you that the question before us is regarding subdivision 3 and 4. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, my question is about this section. My understanding is in lines 3.11 through 3.18, this section does have this rebuttable presumption. So to Representative Grossel's question, it appears that if there's a violation, anyone who lost the bid, regardless of the reason, can sue for damages of what they would have received had they won the award. Is that, could someone say if my understanding there is correct?
Mr. Cummins?
Yes, your understanding is correct that a disappointed bidder could sue, but they would have had to submit a compliant bid using contractors that meet the safe and skilled workforce requirement and have lost the work to a contractor that does not meet the requirement. And that's a very common type of lawsuit that you see, and it is actually provided for in Minnesota Statutes 181.721, construction bid equity, where there's a contractor that doesn't comply with the workers' compensation and unemployment laws. A disappointed bidder can sue. I'm not aware of any lawsuits that have actually been filed. I did a Westlaw search and didn't see any, but it is designed to be a deterrent, as other private right of action languages and other statutes, a deterrent to violators.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. And that other section of statute that you cite, does that also contain this rebuttable presumption?
Yes. In fact, I copied and pasted the language. Oh. Madam Chair, members of the committee, sorry. The language, in my understanding, is copied and pasted from that other provision. I will say, to note, House Research had some technical comments about this provision, and that particular clause of rebuttable presumption was one of the concerns they raised. And although it is already, that very sentence is already in another provision of Minnesota statute, they expressed concerns about its clarity. And my sense is it makes sense to take that sentence out. It really isn't essential to the provision. The basic intent of the provision is to provide for a private right of action to enforce this provision. And the courts can decide, you know, if someone has standing or not, if someone has, in fact, experienced damages from a violation. So, you know, at the recommendation of House Research, that provision may not survive in the bill, as a technical recommendation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm actually going to let Representative Liz Lagarde respond to that comment about that particular sentence in the bill.
Excuse me?
Wondering, Representative Liz Lagarde, the testifier was speaking to a sentence in the bill on line 3.13, maybe not being necessary, and I'm wondering what your response is to that.
Can you please, I do not have the bill sitting right in front of me, Madam Chair, what is the sentence that you'd like me to reply?
Mr. Cummins had spoken to there is a rebuttable presumption that a losing bidder for work for which the violation of the section has occurred has suffered damages. And Mr. Cummins, interrupt me if I'm incorrect, but he is suggesting that that may not be necessary. Is someone from House Research able to weigh in?
Chair and members of the committee, this is Mary Mullen. I had talked.
Go ahead, Ms. Mullen.
Thanks. I had talked to Representative Liz Lagarde and the advocates for the bill to discuss cleaning up some of the language because it was a little bit unorthodox for the way we normally talk about civil liability and civil actions. I did not remove anything, but they did send me back some language that made changes that that sort of made it more consistent with how we normally draft those sections.
Madam Chair, I will, taking that into consideration, I will draft up an amendment, whatever stop this, I believe it's going to the General Register. I will have an amendment drawn up to address this issue.
And Representative Liz Lagarde, knowing that we're sending this to the General Register, typically we, if we find things in committee, sometimes it can be best to deal with that now. I'm wondering what I'm going to do. Let's see. We will, wondering if you would entertain an oral amendment to take out the sentence that House Research is recommending may not be necessary.
Madam Chair, I will do whatever we can to move this forward to protect the worker safety. So,
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members of the committee, there isn't a sentence I'm recommending to be removed. I do think that this would be much better done with a written amendment. There are multiple clarifying suggestions throughout that section of the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Members, I am going to lay this bill over so that Representative Liz Lagarde can have some discussions with House Research and that we can get something drafted that we can get before us. We'll come back to this as soon as we can. So, Representative Liz Lagarde, if you could get in touch with Ms. Mullen right now and work on that and make sure that we're clearing this up. I think it's important that we deal with this now and not on the House floor if we can get it cleaned up ahead of that time. So with that, Representative Liz Lagarde, I see you nodding. So I am laying over House File 984, and we will come back to this today. And hopefully that will clear up some of the questions that members had as well. So House File 984 is laid over. And we're going to move right on to the next bill. Representative Robbins, if you have questions when we come back, we will get to you. I know that I thank you for your attentiveness to the bill. And so with that, we will move on to House File 12. We do have several testifiers on this bill, and I want to make sure that we have time to get to that today, this morning. So this is a Representative Hausman bill, House File 12. I will move that House File 12 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. We have the bill before us, and I guess Representative Liz Lagarde will have to wait a minute to call Ms. Mullen, as I believe Ms. Mullen was going to give us a quick walkthrough of House File 12.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to go ahead and quickly give you an overview of House File 12. This is the first engrossment after it's been amended. The first section deals with the peacetime emergency, and it prohibits evictions for residential tenants during the COVID-19 peacetime emergency, except in specific cases where there's been destruction of rental property, criminal activity, or a substantial breach of the lease. And then it prohibits the non-renewal of leases for residential tenants in similar kinds of circumstances. Section 2 deals with evictions and non-renewals at the conclusion of the peacetime emergency, and it provides for 12 months after the peacetime emergency that a landlord needs to provide a written notice, a 60-day notice, before filing an eviction on a residential tenant. And that also has specific exemption situations where you don't have to do that, such as those like emergency type of situations. Section 3 requires the court to review all filings for evictions so that if the 60-day notice requirement wasn't done after the peacetime emergency, the court can reject the filing. And then for all evictions that are filed after March 23rd, 2020, when those evictions were done, they need to have been done properly. Otherwise, the court can dismiss those eviction actions and expunge the record. For Section 4, this deals with foreclosures, and it provides that during the peacetime emergency and for 60 days after the procedure that begins the foreclosure, the most common type of foreclosure in Minnesota, there's a moratorium on that action. And it also prevents the termination of a contract for deed. So if the home sale was going to be through contract for deed, it can't be canceled during the peacetime emergency or 60 days after. And that's everything.
Madam Chair.
All right. Thanks, Ms. Mullen. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's the content of the bill. I'd like to say just a little bit about why we need this. We're calling this an off-ramp for the eviction moratorium. When the pandemic began, very quickly, workers in bars, restaurants, and retail lost their jobs. And that's a group, we know something about their wage levels. They're probably a group of workers who are one paycheck away from not being able to pay their bills. So the governor quickly realized we can't have more homeless people at the time of a pandemic. And so he called for this eviction moratorium. We then quickly knew we need to keep everyone whole, though, including landlords. And so there was $100 million of housing assistance that we applied to this and set up a program that would pay the rent for this group of people directly to the landlords. But now we're nearing the end, and we need a plan, an off-ramp for the eviction moratorium, because we don't want chaos at the end of that point where we again have a huge number of evictions. And so we're calling this an off-ramp for the eviction moratorium. We're still in a pandemic. And while there are signs of progress, we don't want to take action too quickly. Research shows, you might hear it from one of the testifiers, an increased spread in states that lifted their moratorium in 2020. So we have some experience with this already. The executive order has been critical to providing housing stability during the pandemic. It has had its implementation challenges and unintended consequences. This bill, for the most egregious violations of leases, allows for additional eviction filings to proceed. Once we're through the public health threat, the off-ramp should provide enough notification and timing for individuals and landlords to have access to the federal emergency rental assistance for non-payment of rent evictions. The state has $375 million in emergency rental assistance, so we have some federal money to help us through this time. There is an opportunity to work with the courts to limit the number of evictions filed and to immediately expunge filings that were filed in violation of the emergency orders. So a number of testifiers will talk more about this.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hausman. And I'm sorry that I didn't go to you first. I wanted to make sure we had Ms. Mullen's testimony on the record before we move on to the next issue she needed to attend to. The first testifier I have on the list is Ron Elwood. Mr. Elwood, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Legal Aid would like to thank Chair Hausman and the authors of House File 12 for putting forth a proposal that announces that we need an orderly transition to a housing and eviction future as we emerge from the cloud of personal and economic disruption caused by the pandemic. This bill tackles one of the most critically important issues facing the legislature this year, or frankly in any other years. While hope has arrived on the health front, we are and will continue to be for some time in the throes of an economic fallout from the unprecedented period in our lives. The economic consequences of this pandemic have been felt by all of us, but for some of us, it has been and will continue to be far more severe. I want to amplify what Chair Hausman said regarding the context of this bill. Some statistics that are very sobering. The Center for the American Experiment points out that Minnesota has lost 230,000 jobs between January 2020 and January 2021. Deed reports that Minnesota lost 50,000 jobs in December alone. And Deed's analysis shows that unemployment has been far worse in this pandemic than in both the recessions of the early 2000s and following the foreclosure crisis. According to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, hospitality workers have been hit the hardest. The chamber also points out that employees of color are experiencing disproportionate impacts from this crisis. And the Star Tribune reports that women of color in particular have faced higher percentages of layoffs than any other group during this pandemic. As Chair Hausman noted, many of these workers are renters. Many are low income and many are legal aid clients. So all this is to say that we are not out of the economic woods and that we must be mindful of renters struggling to recover jobs and hours and ensure a measured process of returning to pre-pandemic business as it relates to evictions. While there are differing opinions as to how steep the cliff will be once the moratorium ends, it is undeniable that unless there is a ramp down, there is a potential for an eviction surge. And one of the goals of House File 12 is preventing a wave of evictions that would destabilize families, landlords, and overwhelm the courts. The Census Bureau notes that for the week ending March 1st, about 117,000 Minnesotans are not caught up on rent. That's near 89,000 households have experienced a loss of income, and 82,000 renters are unemployed. If all 117,000 Minnesotans who are backed up on their rent would be face eviction on day one, that would represent 17 times the number of evictions for an entire year in Minnesota. So Legal Aid appreciates the intent of House File 12, and in particular to recognize the provision of a post-moratorium pre-eviction notice period. The 60-day period contemplated in this bill lines up nicely with the time that it will likely take to apply for and administer the financial assistance coming from the federal government and possibly from state sources and get the money out the door to landlords. Legal Aid also appreciates the recognition that protection for contract for deed vendees is also necessary, and as Ms. Mullen pointed out, is contained in this bill. Legal Aid looks forward to working with all the interested stakeholders as this bill moves forward to ensure a smooth transition and hopefully make some long-term structural improvements to enable both landlords and tenants to prevent evictions and avoid eviction court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Next on the list, I have Larry McDonough. Mr. McDonough, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony, keeping in mind that we've got a very full schedule this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Larry McDonough. I'm with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Just want to put a few numbers up for you, and so I will share my screen, but I will keep it very brief. And this slideshow is part of your packet. As Mr. Elwood and also Representative Hausman was talking about, the health effects of the executive order, essentially the issue is if you evict this household during a pandemic, they're going to coalesce with another household in a shelter, in a tent, or in another property, and that increases infections. I've been reviewing health data from around the country, and my estimate in Minnesota is that the executive order saved 2,000 lives up to January 4 and even more since then. There are about 16,000 evictions a year in Minnesota in a regular economy. And so just to give you a few numbers based on where we are in the economy right now, unemployment applications as a share of the workforce during the pandemic have ranged anywhere from one-third to two-thirds of the workforce. You can see here, this is all around the state. When you look at the census data, you can pick any one of these numbers. These are census surveys that are done every week. As of March 10th, these are the estimates of people impacted, tenants impacted by the pandemic. If you take any one of these numbers, even the smallest number, we're having many multiples of the annual eviction rate in Minnesota at one time. And so this is a time to plan. And the one objection I have to the bill, which is it's much better than the Senate file 1470, which creates an off-ramp regardless of health. This bill does have an impact on health in terms of saying we'll open it up at some point when the peacetime emergency is over. But the expansion of evictions before that time is going to be problematic for the reasons I mentioned before. Thank you very much for letting me testify.
Thank you, Mr. McDonough. Next on the list is someone from Homeline. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce your name. Mike Vray, if you could introduce yourself for the committee and then go ahead with your testimony.
It's Mike Vray. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and members. I'm the managing attorney at Homeline. Our tenant hotline advises over 1,000 renters each month. We've submitted more detailed written testimony on House File 12, but in short, we believe this bill is largely a measured plan for transitioning the suspension into statute that later will prevent non-payment evictions by requiring a reasonable timeline with clear and detailed notices, as well as allowing expungements when appropriate. Given the experiences of our clients, we're concerned a shift in the eviction suspension before rental assistance is made widely available will lead to more tenants being displaced, and off-ramp must wait until the public health emergency is safely behind us, which this bill mostly accomplishes. That being said, we oppose allowing an eviction or a notice for material violation, breach of the lease during the public health crisis, as it will lead to displacement and further negative health outcomes. By allowing informal notices to terminate or non-renew leases for material violations, some landlords will use this as an opportunity to terminate for non-payment of rent, creating extra judicial displacements of tenants. If a new exception for eviction filings must be added for material violations, appropriate notice is essential. The notice in this bill is 7 days during the peacetime emergency, which for many could be shorter than the 45 days proposed in the Senate's bill. Notice period for these evictions is 0 days in the 12-month post-emergency period. Reasonable notice allows tenants to remedy situations or move before an eviction. The 60-day notice post-emergency for non-payment evictions in this bill is a good model for improving other notice requirements. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cecil Smith. I am president and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. MHA is made up of 1,800 members representing 400,000 units in Minnesota. And I also own and operate an apartment portfolio. MHA respectfully raises our opposition to House File 12. This proposal is not an off-ramp. It is a series of two cliffs that divide the eviction cliff contemplated at the end of the peacetime emergency. The first cliff will be when the eviction filings are permitted the day after enactment for breaches of lease. The second cliff will be 60 days after the end of the governor's peacetime emergency when it permits evictions due to non-payment. Alternatively, MHA has provided advice to the legislature and governor on an orderly five-step process to end the moratorium. Minnesota courts have a significant body of case law which has established the judicial definition for material breach of lease. MHA is still evaluating this proposed definition as it accords with existing case law which has been established by the courts. MHA has concerns about Section 1, Subdivision 1F, as it relates to the 1984 statute on rent control prohibitions in Section 1, Subdivision 1E, also prohibits late fees, which would be an impairment of contracts under the Minnesota Constitution. Additionally, a blanket automatic expungement is too broad. The proposal extends the existing moratorium into a 12-month period, where a 60-day notice must be provided prior to filing an eviction action or lease termination for non-payment. A 60-day notice is twice as long as any other notice period in the United States and over four times longer than any other legislation previously considered in this committee. This is counterproductive to housing market stability, as it could put more small operators at risk for another 12 months following the 12 months that they have already endured. The best way to ensure housing stability is to get the rental assistance program running effectively. With $100 million previously in the CARES Act and $375 million from the CAA, and now approximately $200 to $300 million coming from the American Rescue Plan Act, we have an abundance of funding to ensure housing stability for most renters. The agency has these incredible resources available to them and should efficiently take applications and get the checks in the mail to property managers. Unfortunately, I'm disappointed to report that I'm still waiting for a rent check, which was promised to my renter through the CARES Act chat program in December for December rent. Indeed, December rent. We're in late March now. My resident regularly asks me if we've received it, but the answer is still nothing yet. This promise of rent assistance from the government for this singular resident is not a strain on our business. However, the same cannot be said for my resident who still bears the stress of lingering unpaid rent. Finally, it's apparent that this bill, as I pointed out earlier, is unfortunately attempting to advance a set of landlord tenancy policy issues which are in no way relevant to ending the eviction moratorium. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify and for your consideration of my testimony.
Thank you. And the last testifier I have on the list is Paul Eager. If you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Eager, and I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 12. COVID-19 has presented challenges for homeowners, renters, and housing providers. When renters struggle to pay rent, housing providers often struggle to keep properties afloat. The longer the eviction moratorium is in place without a plan for an orderly and reasonable process for emerging from it, the more difficult that transition will be. While we appreciate Chair Hausman beginning this discussion, we do not see how House File 12 would provide for an orderly process for ending the eviction moratorium and transitioning back to practices dictated by current law. Rental assistance dollars that will be available soon are critical for both tenants and housing providers, and should be a significant factor in facilitating the transition from the eviction moratorium. In the December federal COVID-19 relief bill you heard in previous testimony, Minnesota received $375 million for rental assistance, which should be going out soon. And the state is expecting another allocation of dollars from the latest bill that was signed into law just last week. We're also pleased that bill included almost $10 billion for homeowner assistance. Those dollars represent an important tool to build a bridge from where we are today to the post-eviction moratorium period ahead. However, House File 12 does not appear to attempt to leverage those rental assistance dollars to craft a phased off-ramp that could minimize impacts on both tenants and housing providers. We also share Mr. Smith's concerns about the rent control provision that's found on page 2, lines 22 through 24 of the bill. And finally, Madam Chair, Section 4 addresses foreclosures and contracts for deed cancellation, and seems to be an expansion on the existing executive order and a new requirement, which we would like to better understand, particularly how it may impact the ability to access and maintain vacant foreclosed properties. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and we look forward to working with Chair Hausman, the members of both chambers, and all stakeholders as this discussion continues. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll move to member discussion. Our Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to everybody that testified this morning. Representative Hausman, I'm just wondering, what your thoughts are. I mean, the federal government's already given $100 million towards this. Are the local county agencies and housing agencies, are they not getting this money out the door?
Madam Chair, and I'm Lael Robertson is on the call. She's the from Minnesota Housing, and I would like to invite her into the conversation as well. I should have checked this before. I think most of the $100 million is out the door, and maybe Ms. Robertson can. And I don't know if Ryan Baumtag is on from the agency either, but if one of them can speak to how much of that $100 million is out the door. I think virtually all of it is out.
Yep, and we'll go to Ms. Robertson. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lael Robertson, and I'm the policy attorney at Minnesota Housing. Madam Chair and Representative Scott, it's my understanding that that $100 million is almost completely out the door. We are, with the new money, the agency will be utilizing a more centralized payment processing system in an attempt to improve processing payment processing. That has not started yet. The agency is still, as you can imagine, with a mass amount of money, we're still putting together that process, but we are working very closely with the local partners, including Hennepin County and Ramsey County, City of Minneapolis, City of St. Paul, to get the money out the door.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this testifier just said it, a mass amount of money is coming from the federal government. And if there was a problem of getting this money in renters' hands, then that falls on the government itself and not having a proper rollout. You know, I think that this legislation is not an off-ramp. It is prolonging a problem. I think most of you received a letter from a gentleman. I think he sent it to every legislator. He's a landlord. He doesn't have a job. And the renters that he has are both still working, but during this moratorium decided not to pay the rent. So they're almost a year behind on making their rent payments to him. When you get that far behind, it's almost impossible to catch up. And they have not applied for any rental assistance. So there are people that fall into this category. And this bill is going to do nothing but prolong the problem. And I think I have not seen it, but the Minnesota Housing, I think it was Minnesota Multi-Housing, said that they have a five-step plan that they presented to the governor that would actually be an off-ramp to this. There's no question there's probably going to be an increase in evictions filed following the end of this moratorium. But what we're doing here is prolonging the problem. In addition, this bill institutes rent control. It's like, oh, let's just put that in while we're at it here. So this bill is very problematic, and it's not balanced at all between the renter and the landlords. 60-day notice for eviction, that's just getting people more and more behind on their rent. This bill's really problematic, and I'll be urging my vote or my team to vote against it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Members, any additional discussion to the bill? All right, Representative Hausman, any closing words on the bill?
Thank you. You can see we balance the tensions between landlords and renters in Minnesota. We really wanted to get the money directly to the landlords, which so that first $100 million, that was our goal, because it's in everybody's best interest to keep this housing safe. And so we're steering up a course down the middle somehow between those two.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hausman. I will renew my motion that House File 12 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel. Representative Grossel. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Morton.
Madam Chair. No.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Fain.
No.
Aye.
Representative Shong.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I lost sound.
Representative Grossel.
Representative Grossel's no. I apologize. I'm trying to get the sound back.
Okay. There are 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right. With that, the motion prevails and House File 12 is recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Not sure who that was.
I just thanked you.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Representative Hausman. We've got a busy schedule. Thank you very much. With that, we'll move on to House File 927, Representative Cagle's bill. Representative Cagle, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 927 be recommended to be re-referred to Housing, Finance, and Policy. The bill is now before us. Representative Cagle, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 927 is follow-up to legislation that was signed into law in 2017 that addresses a number of issues with manufactured home titlings. Titling a manufactured home is complicated because the law by default treats these homes as personal property, similar to that of a car. There is, however, a process in law that manufactured homeowners can go through to make the home real property. This bill seeks to simplify that process for both the homeowner and the Department of Public Safety and Driver and Vehicle Services, along with making some other clarifying changes. This bill limits that option to situations where the certificate of title has been lost, destroyed, or becomes ineligible. Homeowners who are in possession of their original title still must send that title to DVS. And so there are a number of stakeholders with interest in this topic that have been working on the language, including Minnesota Realtors, Minnesota Land Title Association, Minnesota Manufactured Modular Homes Association, the Minnesota Bankers Association, Minnesota Credit Union Network, Minnesota State Bar Association, and DPS and DVS. We're not aware of any opposition to this bill. And with that, I'd like to thank the committee members for their time and then hand it over to my testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cagle. First on the list, I have Matthew Spellman. Mr. Spellman, you have 2 minutes. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I can be quicker than that. So my name, for the record, my name is Matt Spellman. I'm with the Minnesota Realtors. I would like to first thank Representative Cagle and all the stakeholders that she mentioned for their work on this, particularly John Nielsen, who is joining me on the call with Minnesota Land Title. Representative Cagle did a really good job introducing the bill. The primary function of this is to simplify the process manufactured homeowners go through when changing the status of their home from personal property to real property. When a manufactured homeowner wants to go through that process of affixing their home to the land and make it real property, they must first cancel their certificate of title within the Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services records so that the property can then be recorded in the county land records. This process can be difficult for homeowners because oftentimes they lose or misplace their certificate of title. And so, like Representative Cagle said, this bill would allow these homeowners to cancel their certificate of title by written request if the title has been lost, destroyed, or rendered ineligible, making this process far simpler for both the homeowner as well as DVS. Like she said, the bill makes a number of clarifying changes that we are unaware of any opposition. And that's kind of what I got. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to turn it over to John.
Thank you, Mr. Spellman. John Nielsen, if you could introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name's John Nielsen. I'm an attorney at Old Republic National Title Insurance Company, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Land Title Association, which is the state-level trade association for title companies in Minnesota. And we search and analyze the county land records, do closings for commercial and residential property, and we end up getting involved in this issue because we help consumers complete this process of turning their mobile home from personal property like a car into real estate like a house that was built on site. We also issue some title policies that give some coverages related to that fact that the home is now part of the real estate. I was one of the main drafters on the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions. I think the representative and Mr. Spellman gave a good outline that the process is being simplified a bit if you've lost your title, and then also does a number of cleanup and more technical changes to the process. We'd ask that you support the bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. I will say I just signed on to the bill as a co-author. So this is a good bill. Members, any discussion to House File 927? All right. Seeing no hands going up, Representative Cagle, any closing comments?
It's a good bill. I appreciate your support.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 927 be recommended to be re-referred to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Navani.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Fang.
Aye.
Representative Sean. Representative
Sean. Aye.
Perfect. There are 17 ayes and no nays.
With that, the motion prevails and House File 927 is recommended to be re-referred to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. With that, members, we have several bills up this evening, so we will be coming back this evening. So we will not be adjourning right now, and so stay tuned. We're scheduled for 5 o'clock right now, but depending upon how things go on the floor, just pay attention to your email if there are any updates about when we will be reconvening. And with that, the committee stands in recess. All right, I call this meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee back to order. We will get right to work, members, so we can wrap things up tonight. First, we're going to start with House File 984. That was the Lys-Lagarde bill that we laid over this morning. So I will move that House File 984 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. As was emailed out to folks earlier today, there is now an amendment. It is the A1 amendment to put the bill in the that the author would like. Representative Lys-Lagarde, anything you want to say about your amendment? Otherwise, we'll move straight to it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I want to apologize to the committee for the snafu and the confusion earlier today. I didn't want to waste any of your time. With that said, I also want to thank you for laying it over and allowing me to come back, and also to thank the staff for their hard work to put this together so we can come back before you. So, if anybody has any questions, I do have Mr. Cummins to walk through the amendment. And thank Mrs. Representative Robbins for her question that spurred the discussion.
All right. Members, any discussion to the amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the A1 amendment is adopted. The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Robbins, did you have anything else you wanted to say? I know we kind of cut you off earlier when we realized there was an issue that needed to be fixed. So, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nope, it's great, and I just appreciate everyone pulling together and getting it done. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I was presenting a bill in a different committee when this bill was before us, and so could I ask a couple of questions on the bill? Is that all right, Madam Chair? Is that in order?
You know, we have a couple minutes. Obviously, we started a lot later than we meant to tonight, but out of respect to you, if you have a couple questions, but we're not going to get into a full member discussion of everyone else who's already sort of had a bite at the apple.
Right. I understand. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. So, Representative Lys-Lagarde, my question, and maybe it was asked when I wasn't there, but there's a provision in here that it talks about the gravity of the violation and a judge determining kind of where to go with the penalties and where to go with the case dependent on the gravity of the violation. And I'm wondering if there's a definition for that. And if that's anywhere else in statute where that's what a judge or the commissioner of labor has to go on. Is there any other area of statute that has that? And what is the definition of it? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lys-Lagarde, I'm guessing that's a question maybe for Mr. Cummins, since he's the attorney testifying on this bill. Mr. Cummins, if you could reintroduce yourself for the record and then answer that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brendan Cummins, attorney for the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. The answer to your question is yes, that type of provision does appear elsewhere in statute. For example, in the record keeping provision, Minnesota Statute Section 177.30, there is a penalty provision with that identical language about the gravity of the violation. And it is within the discretion of the Department of Labor and Industry to determine the gravity of the violation. There is also a provision in Minnesota Statutes 177.27 that allows for the commissioner to determine the seriousness of violation for purposes of imposing a penalty. So that's actually a very common formulation, and the language here was modeled after what exists already.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a follow-up, but a related question to the civil actions section, where you can bring a civil action if you don't get the bid, and it can be, you know, if somebody has a bid for $100 million and somebody else has one for $50 million, does the person that doesn't get the bid, it looks to me like, according to this language, that they're entitled to, the losing bidder is entitled to damages up to that amount of the difference.
And I'll just remind members that this is the part of the bill that was amended with the amendment. Mr. Cummins.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that provision regarding a rebuttable presumption of lost profits damages has been removed. Measure of damages would be determined in the individual case based on principles of causation and proof of loss, and the judge would have to make a decision, or jury, case by case, as to what the appropriate damages are. We did remove that provision because of the confusion that it seemed to be causing.
Final follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to ask a couple of questions. I'm glad that was removed. I think that was just, I'd never seen anything like it. I thought it was a little bit on the ludicrous side to even put something like that in bill form. So thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your generosity with the time. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. All right, Representative Lislegard, any closing comments on the bill?
No, just simply that this is about worker safety, and it's about creating an opportunity for people to be trained and have the oversight. And if this isn't a Democrat or Republican, union versus non-union, this is about people and their ability to go home safe to their family and their community. So I appreciate your support. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lislegard. With that, I renew my motion that House File 984, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll. Anna, it's you're on.
I can do it. Chair Becker Finn.
Right. Anna, are you on now? She may be having some technical difficulties. Ms. Ghanani, if you could go ahead with the roll.
Sure. Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grassl?
No.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
There being, or there's 10 ayes and 7 nays.
That with that, the motion prevails and House File 984 is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Thank you, Representative Lislegarde, and thanks for coming back tonight so we could get that moved. Gonna keep rolling, guys, onto the next bill. The next bill on the agenda is House File 800. It is a Representative Wolgamott bill. We'll just remind members that we're gonna stick to Section 6 of the bill regarding enforcement and compliance, as that's the part of the bill that is in our jurisdiction. Welcome to the committee, Representative Wolgamott. I will move that House File 800 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Wolgamott, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here tonight to present House File 800, which is the Safe Workplaces for Meat and Poultry Processing Workers Act. Last year, I heard horrifying and heartbreaking stories from my constituents in central Minnesota when the COVID-19 pandemic first hit our community about inhumane working conditions in meat processing plants. This legislation provides comprehensive workplace health and safety protocols and ensures workers have access to the benefits and training needed to work safely during this pandemic and beyond. Additionally, this bill establishes a workers' rights coordinator housed within the Department of Labor and Industry that is dedicated to enforcement and compliance. These workers have unnecessarily sacrificed their physical health and the financial health of their families to keep Minnesota communities fed if they deserve adequate safety protections. All Minnesotans will benefit by having safe meat and poultry processing plants, safe food, and healthy workers. That's why I'm bringing this bill forward. And with that, Madam Chair, I will kick it over to my testifiers here to share their perspective and why this bill is so important for our entire state.
All right, thank you, Representative Wolgamott. First on the list is Rena Wong, and I'll just remind testifiers that it's been a very long day for legislators, so if we could stay focused on our testimony, we would all appreciate it. Ms. Wong, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good evening, Chair Beckerfin and members of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. My name is Rena Wong, and I'm the organizing director of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 663. Our local represents 13,200 hardworking union retail, meat packing, processing, food preparation, manufacturing, healthcare, and other workers in Minnesota and Iowa. I'm here to testify to the importance and need for consistent enforcement policies and accountability measures that protect meatpacking and poultry workers' safety. Meatpacking is one of the most dangerous industries for workers on the job. Health and safety is continuously brought up as one of the important issues facing meat and poultry workers in Minnesota. Last year, COVID-19 outbreaks in Worthington wreaked havoc in the pork plant where our union members work. Before and during the outbreak at the JBS plant and its subsequent closure, we pieced together guidelines to protect meatpacking and poultry workers from the deadly virus. UFCW was instrumental in crafting the guidelines and advised the state of Minnesota on them. Together with the state of Minnesota, we were able to publish the guidelines and have them available to meatpacking employers and workers throughout the state, union and non-union. The guidelines developed are a step in the right direction for employers. We also recognize that guidelines are just that, a way to encourage safe behavior and practices without accountability. Guidelines are not a permanent solution to an industry that will continue to be dangerous for workers. The Meatpacking Worker Bill of Rights was a good first step back in 2007, and the COVID-19 meatpacking safety guidelines helps during the pandemic, but the next logical step is to pass this bill, House File 800. This legislation is long overdue. Accountability measures provide consistency in application of this legislation, such as workers' rights coordinator that is appointed by the DLI commissioner and shall enforce all the provisions of the act with the ability to prosecute and or investigate by the attorney general, district attorney, and any city or county attorney. Everyone knows that when you hear the term OSHA, it's a reactive agency. This bill is going to help them be, is going to help the DLI be proactive. We have the opportunity to hold employers more accountable for worker safety with House File 800. This bill provides enforcement and penalties to hold employers accountable if they do not follow the law and do their best to protect workers. We are asking for a fair and level playing field for the safety of meatpacking workers in Minnesota. House File 800 provides consistency and accountability that is sorely needed in this dangerous industry. The state must do better for these workers. Please pass House File 800, and thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you, Ms. Wong. Next on the list, I have Matt Utek. If you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Matt was not able to make it. I was speaking in his stead for the local.
Got it. Thank you, Ms. Wong. I will go to the next testifier, which I know I saw her here, Lisa Toma. If you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good evening, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Toma. I am a United Food and Commercial Workers Local 663 member who has worked at the JBS plant for 31 years in Worthington. I am here today to support the passage of House File 800, Minnesota Safe Workplaces for Meatpacking and Poultry Processing Workers Act. I am a walking steward at the plant, which means that I listen to and address concerns of workers and enforce the union contract. I also worked there for a very long time, and I have seen how dangerous the meatpacking industry can be, both throughout COVID and pre-COVID times. The speed and the pace of the work at the plant is fast, whether you work on the line, handle boxes, or drive forklift. In addition to the fast speeds, the tools required to perform the work require gripping and force, as well as repetitive motions. In addition to all these movements, we now wear additional PPE because of COVID, and it still doesn't eliminate the risk of catching COVID. It simply minimizes it. Safety and health goals are also unachievable because of the speed and the pace of the work. We are constantly vigilant, but it is always go, go, go. I know what it is like. I have work injuries. I lost 60% of a disc in my back, suffered elbow injuries, issues with my fingers, even had my shoulder lock up during the course of working at the plant. The goal of safety is to go home in the same condition that I came to work in. House File 800 is necessary because it would allow all meat and poultry processing workers to reserve the right to refuse unsafe work, which is defined as conditions that the worker believes would expose themselves, other workers, or the public to an unreasonable risk or illness, including COVID-19. The bill will also fill the dire need to provide for accountability in a dangerous meatpacking industry. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't have anyone else on the list to testify this evening. Members, any discussion to Section 6 of the bill? Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I have a few questions, and this may be for the testifiers. I'm just wondering what they do now if they see something at work that is unsafe. What's the protocol right now?
I'm not sure which one of you wants to take that. Ms. Wong.
Sure. I think Lisa can speak to what happens in the union plants. As she said, she is a walking steward. But, you know, in non-union plants, we've heard a lot of reports, especially during COVID, that they've brought up issues to management up in Representative Wolgamott's district. And those concerns were, you know, workers said that they did not feel that their concerns were being met. Despite OSHA being able to come and try to help the situation, hundreds of workers still contracted COVID, and they did in the workplace because, you know, their concerns around PPE and social distancing were not met when they did bring it up to management. But I'll let Lisa speak to the union plants, how that happens.
Ms. Toma.
So the good thing is that we are a union shop, and that the role that I have in that plant is to consistently keep an eye on that company. That company has a goal, and that goal is profits and greed. So in order to protect the workers and to keep an eye on those speeds that are currently agreed upon in those plants, I check those speeds on a constant basis. I'm also put on notice by union workers when they feel that the speed is going too fast. I'll also be told that my name goes out over the radio that the management use when I hit the floors to check the speeds. So if that doesn't give you an indicator on what kind of operations that we are inside of and working inside of, and why it is so important to have an entity really put in some stiff penalties to help enforce these type of rules to make sure that workers are protected. Nobody goes to work with the intent to get hurt. All of us want to go home in the same condition, like I said earlier, and that we came to work in. But unless there are some really good bills out there that are passed to hold these employers responsible, we are at will right now.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, there's just kind of a lot to unpack there. Number one, Ms. Wong spoke that she heard that this was going on in non-union operations. She wasn't inside to know and see for herself. I think you have to remember, too, that at the early onset of COVID, we didn't know what we were dealing with. These workers were deemed as essential workers, and that was before they kind of knew how to handle that kind of workplace environment. We've learned a lot since then. And in fact, now I know that we had initially some outbreaks, and I believe outbreaks were in the union shops, if I'm not mistaken. And since that time, most of the COVID cases have come out of nursing homes. So I guess my question to the bill's author would be, why are you just narrowing in on the food packing, the food industry here, when there are a whole host of other areas of our economy that have experienced more COVID cases? And it seems to me that there's already regulation upon regulation upon regulation upon regulation upon these factories. And they've got OSHA, they've got international guidelines, they've got DALI. Right now they can be fined. Right now they can, if somebody gets hurt on their work at work, they can be sued for that. So I question the need for this bill. It seems to me more of just, you want more people to be part of union shops, and so you bring this bill. So I just was interested in hearing Representative Wolgamott's response to any of those comments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, I made the decision to bring this bill forward with the current scope of protecting meat and poultry processing plant workers because of the stories that I heard from my constituents. Constituents coming to me saying, we're not safe at work. People are getting sick. They're not giving us PPE. They're not giving us, they're not doing, training. They're not keeping things sanitized. I have to make this tough decision, Representative Wolgamott. What do you think I should do? Should I go into work and risk getting sick so that I can earn money? My family, or should I stay home from work so that I can protect my physical health, but then I'm not going to be able to earn a paycheck? I don't want to live in a Minnesota where people are having to make that kind of decision. So that's why I've worked with my constituents and others to put this bill forward. Like you said, it's not comprehensive of every single place throughout the state where there have been COVID outbreaks. You mentioned a few other sectors of the economy. I guess that's just not the scope of what my bill is trying to accomplish. If there are other sectors of the economy that you think need more safety and better training and things like that, I definitely would encourage you to bring forward a bill, Representative Scott, and I'd be more than glad to talk with you about that. But that's the scope of my bill is meat and poultry processing workers, because that's the kind of constituents that I've heard from on this. As far as whether or not these regulations are needed when we have all these other regulations, Everything is just fine. Why do we need more regulations? I would defer. I see that my testifier, Ms. Wong, has her hand up, and I would invite her to join the conversation.
Ms. Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, when we had our conversations initially with Representative Wolgamott, it was because of this past year, but also even beyond COVID, meatpacking as an industry, has one of the highest rates of injury, and workers need protection. This bill is meant to be proactive. It's meant to provide enforcement through the Attorney General's office. It's meant to provide somebody at the Department of Labor who can really enforce. Usually when OSHA gets called in, it's because there's already been an injury, because somebody has been hurt, because something has happened in the workplace. And we don't want to just be we want to be proactive. We don't want to just be reactive, especially in an industry when workers' lives are at stake. And certainly in the past year, not just their own lives, but their families' lives, because they've taken home the disease that they've caught at work.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So I'd be interested to know, how many of these facilities are encouraging people to get vaccinated at this point. That's a one surefire way, and especially in an environment like that, you'd think it'd be encouraged. And I put together a bill with Representative Erickson to get teachers to the front of the second round of the vaccinations, because we want kids to get back to school, because it's vital that that happens. And I didn't see, Representative Wolgamott or anybody else bringing a bill to put these folks, their safety at the front. They're essential workers, basically dealing with our food supply. You could have brought a bill to say, let's move them to the front of the line for vaccinations. I question the motivation behind all this. It seems to me that most places...
Representative Scott, we really clearly will not be questioning motives. That's
all right.
Very clear in the House rules.
I'll rephrase that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll rephrase that. I question the need for this bill when there's already regulation. Every plant has safety managers and safety protocols, union or non-union. They all have those in place. I don't think this is necessary. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Grossel.
Sorry, double clicked on the camera. Thank you, Madam Chair, and for Representative Wolgamott. When you're looking into things like this and looking and hearing from one side, I guess my question would be, have you spoken with any of the processing plant management regarding your bill to understand what do they do to protect the workers? Because I know working in the field as a law enforcement officer, you listen to both sides. If you want to get a good picture of what's going on, you got to listen to both groups.
Representative Wolgamott.
Yes, I have. Madam Chair, Representative Grossel. Yes, I have.
Representative Grossel.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? What have they done?
Representative Wolgamott.
Like I said, right now there are huge needs from the people that I'm hearing from my constituents. I've reached out to some of the bigger ones who I'm the most concerned about. They've had no interest in engaging us on this. I had some really good productive conversations with some of the smaller meatpacking businesses. I'm blanking on the name. It's like the Minnesota Meatpackers Association. And I'm working with them to make sure that, this bill fits their needs and is conducive to their needs and isn't a one-size-fits-all. Clearly, it's not the intention of this bill to put anyone out of business or cause undue hardships on the small mom and pop shops that are doing a nice job already. I've been in just yesterday. House staff and I sat down with them for, I think about an hour working on these things. So, yep, really welcome anybody that wants to work with me on, whether you're big or small, or anyone that wants to work with me on our shared goal of making these places more safe for Minnesota's workers. I welcome that conversation.
Representative Robbins, then we're going to move on to
the vote. Thank you, Madam Chair, I wasn't done yet. That's right.
Okay. Representative Grossel, one more follow-up.
I find myself more and more, as I get older, reading lips. So I find it, it's hard for me to understand a lot of what Representative Wolgamott is saying when he's wearing his mask. I understand, but... And I, I've I'm learning as I go here to try to adapt. So one more question I had was, you know, all these Minnesota food facilities are regulated by seven federal and state agencies, including DALI and four international intergovernmental organizations. Why do we need yet another layer? You're saying the current federal, state, and international agencies aren't doing their jobs, or what do you see and what do you find?
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grossel, I think there needs to be more of a focus on this industry. That's why part of what my bill does is create the position of the workers' rights coordinator so that we can have someone. This is clearly a very unique industry dealing with raw meat and things of that nature. So I'm not really saying that nobody's doing their job. I just think there can be even more focus on you know, standing up for these workers, investigating cases of unsafe working conditions. And again, to have that workers' rights coordinator, someone who can really specialize in this, kind of be a one-stop shop for workers when, you know, when issues come up. I think that we can do better as a state, clearly by what we saw this past year, what we know, what happened with these outbreaks at these plants. Clearly we can do better, and that's why I brought this bill forward. That's why I created this position of workers' rights coordinator to be housed within the Department of Labor and Industry.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Wolgamott. And we'll remind members that the question before us is whether, you know, the discussion to the enforcement and compliance mechanisms in the bill. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Yeah, my question is related to that. In line 4.9 and 4.10, it talks about that coordinator you were just talking about, and that they, on their own initiative, can inspect a meatpacking operation and subpoena records and witnesses. That seems like an awful lot of power for this person. So I just wondered if you could speak to that. Normally, right now, is that not part of what's subject to a bargaining agreement or subject to other requirements that they would have to provide notice? Could you explain that a little bit more? Thank you.
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, yes, again, the point of having a workers' rights coordinator is that we can have some teeth behind these rights. You know, if we pass these rights, but there's no one around to enforce them, what good are we really doing for our workers? So, yes, the intent is that they do have some authority to be able to stand up for these workers. But, Madam Chair, to give an even more thorough answer on that, I would invite, with your permission, I invite Sarai King who's on to weigh in even further on this.
Okay, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your response.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sarai King, and I'm an attorney for the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, and I thank you for letting me join you this evening. The power that the workers' rights coordinator would have is unique, and I think one of the reasons that we need somebody to be able to go in and do additional inspections is because, and Rena sort of alluded to this when she testified earlier, there is a real disjuncture between the amount of complaints that you see informally and the amount of formal complaints that I think Minnesota OSHA and gets. So there is actually a notable gap, and I think we would be happy to provide more information on some of those statistics that show that underreporting is a really major concern. So giving somebody these additional powers to subpoena and to go in and do unannounced inspections puts much more teeth into the existing protections that workers have.
All right, thank you. And if you could provide that information to the committee administrator, we can share that with the rest of the committee. Any further follow-up, Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quickly, does AgriGrowth support this, or have you spoken to them?
Representative Wolgamott.
AgriGrowth has testified against this bill, but we are working with them. We've invited them to join the conversation on how we can make changes to the bill. We've invited them to the table and invited them to the conversation. The last time we met, the person from AgriGrowth couldn't join us because, or I think I remember this right, that they couldn't join us for some particular reason, but definitely welcome them to the table and continue to be in conversation with us on ways that we can work together. Because, you know, I don't question that that they don't value worker safety. Obviously, we all want to work to keep workers safe. So, yep, definitely invite them to continue to be part of this conversation as this bill moves toward the legislative process.
All right. Representative Frazier, and then we're going to move to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wolgamott, thank you for bringing this bill. And to the senior representative, thank you all for collectively raising the And I think we saw what happened during the pandemic with our workers in these processes. And I am actually very happy that you have this workers' right coordinator there, because it does provide it provides a direct person to address these issues. As an attorney that has worked on behalf of union members and dealt with OSHA and sometimes the delay in the way that we address, it is great to have that is directly attached there that workers can go to directly and kind of to address these issues. So thank you for bringing this bill. I'm looking forward to supporting it. And it's always important to make sure that we are taking care of our senior workers and making sure they have a safe place to work in. Thank you.
Thank you. And I will note, if you have ever butchered an animal, it is a uniquely challenging and physically difficult job for sure. And understand the unique place that our meatpacking workers are in the job that they do. Representative Wolgamott, any closing comments?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members, for your time this evening. I want to ask your support for this legislation to keep meat and poultry processing workers healthy and safe so that they can continue feeding Minnesotan families while not putting their own families and communities at risk. Thank you very much.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 800 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll if her Wi-Fi is now working.
Chairbacker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny. Representative Novotny. Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Fang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Novotny. Representative Novotny. I have 10 ayes and 6 nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 800 is recommended to be referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott and testifiers. The next bill on our agenda is House File 1081. This is a Chair Richardson bill. The committee discussion is going to be limited to Article 3, Section 43. We weren't initially expecting this bill to come to us, but was amended in the previous committee, and now we're going to check over this section. Chair Richardson, I will move that House File 1081 be recommended to be referred to the Education Finance Committee. And I understand you have two author's amendments. The first author's amendment is the A21-0104 amendment, which my notes say was a technical fix on an engrossing error. Chair Richardson, could you just confirm that that's the case with A21-0104?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is correct. It's a technical fix. In the last committee stop, the amendment was divided and only one line was adopted. However, the engrossment included the entire amendment. So this just reflects the correction of that clerical error and will bring it in line with the committee's intent.
Very good. All those in favor of the A21-0104 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. Moving on to the other author's amendment, the A20 author's amendment, I will move the A20 amendment. Chair Richardson, if you could tell us about the A20 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A20 amendment clarifies that any data the committee mentioned in this bill deals with about individual teachers would be private personnel data, and other committee data would be public by default unless it's protected under another law. The amendment mirrors the treatment of individual teacher data in other areas of K-12 education.
All right, very good. All those in favor of the A20 author's amendment?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the A20 amendment is adopted. Chair Richardson, the bill is now before us as amended. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1081 is the Education Policy Omnibus Bill. The section of the bill under the jurisdiction of this committee is Article 3, Section 43, relating to data. The provision is part of the effort to diversify our teaching workforce and to ensure our teachers reflect the diversity of the state. Developing a racially diverse workforce has long been cited as crucial to improving student performance, and the research is clear. All students do better when they have access to Black, Indigenous, and teachers of color. The section of the bill allows a school district and teachers union to agree to a process to exempt up to 5% of the district's employees from unrequested leaves of absences and non-renewals. For districts that opt into the process, they're required to establish a committee. And as part of that process, they will review and evaluate an individual's teaching performance, and the committee will have access to individual educator data that would be private. This section of the bill clarifies that any data the committee deals with about the individual teachers would be private personnel data. And as mentioned before with the amendment, other committee data would be public by default unless protected by another law. I have with me today David Aaron, General Counsel with Education Minnesota, and we're happy to stand for questions.
All right. Any member questions about the provision that's in front of us? Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Richardson, for sending this bill to this committee. That amendment that was put on at the tail end of committee the other day caused it obviously to come to this committee. And so, I mean, obviously classifying the data as private personnel data is the only way to go here. I still question whether this, this select committee should have the ability to see some of this data and to make this decision just overall, you know, I question the even the constitutionality of saying that this only applies to 5% of teachers of color within, you know, there's thousands of teachers in the state of Minnesota. So if you're going to get rid of last in, first out and provide a pathway for more and more teachers, it should apply equally across the board. And so, again, I know the bill's here because of the data provision. It's that part of it's fine. I just fundamentally disagree with this whole select committee and what it's charged with. I think it's not good policy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Members, any further discussion to Article 3, Section 43 of the bill? All right, seeing none, Chair Richardson, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just add that with the language, it allows exemptions for underrepresented educators. So that's broader than just Black, Indigenous, and teachers of color. It includes individuals with disabilities and basically any groups that have faced systemic barriers within education. And I also think it's really important just to highlight all students do better when they have the ability to learn from diverse teachers. So with that, I would just ask for the support of the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Chair Richardson. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1081 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Frazier? Representative Frazier? Representative Grossman?
No.
Representative Hurt?
Aye.
Representative Collins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Frazier? There are 9 ayes and 7 nays.
The motion prevails and House File 1081 as amended is on its way to the Education Finance Committee. Chair Richardson, the next bill on our agenda is also your bill, House File 1200. I will move that House File 1200 be recommended to be referred to the Workforce and Business Development Finance and Policy Committee. Chair Richardson, your bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1200 would create a statewide paid family and medical leave insurance benefit program. The program is modeled after our state's unemployment insurance benefit program and would provide a much needed safety net for families. At some point, the majority of workers will need to take some time away from work to care for a new child, a family member that is sick, or to recover themselves. Caring for others and receiving care is a key component of being human and living a fulfilling life. Unfortunately, the reality for the majority of Minnesotans is not that simple. Only about 13% of the Minnesota workforce has paid family leave through an employer, and an estimated 44% access it through temporary disability programs. There are huge disparities in terms of who has access and who does not. And in the midst of a global pandemic, it's become clear illness can strike at any time, and families, just like businesses, need safety nets. Minnesotans want to work and take care of their families, and this bill can help make that a reality. As our discussion today is limited, I'll provide a quick walkthrough of the relevant provisions of the bill in Article 1. Section 1 makes program data on applicants, family members, or employers private. Section 4 provides data gathered for the benefit program. Things such as wage detail reports or healthcare provider certifications will be shared with the Family and Medical Benefits Division of Deed. Section 12, Subdivision 4, provides after administrative appeals are exhausted, appeals directly to the Court of Appeals are permissible, and this mirrors the unemployment insurance statutes. Under Section 14, the remedies that are available are the same that are currently available under unpaid leave with FMLA. Section 15 allows the commissioner to assess monetary penalties. Section 17 deals with late fees. And again, these are sections that model the UI statutes, and so it's relating to the same information there. Section 21 states that interest on judgments is 1% per month, another UI clone piece. Section 21 deals with legal dissolutions, and that follows the UI statute, as well as Section 22, 26, 29, 30, and 31 all follow the current UI process as it relates to child support, court fees, records and audits, subpoenas, and liens, levies, set-offs, and civil actions. So with that, Madam Chair, happy to stand for questions. And I also have Ms. Deborah Fitzpatrick with me today to answer questions as well.
All right. And then is Ms. Fitzpatrick just here for questions, or did she want to testify as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair. She's just standing by for questions.
All right. Any member discussion to the bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll give it a whirl. This is my time in the legislature. This is one of the most complicated bills that I've ever tried to swallow and digest. There are a lot of moving parts to it, and one of my concerns is that there may be some inconsistencies in the remedies section that may be in conflict with some current laws, both federal and state. One of the things that I think that I have an issue with is the waiver of rights, that would allow an employer and an employee to come to some sort of an agreement or settlement. And because they're getting rid of that, that's not going to encourage the employer and the employee to work something out, to do mediation, something on that front. And so I'm wondering if the bill's author could share with me why you wouldn't want that to happen in a situation like this, and why the bill language takes away that ability to work together to come up with a solution.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott, for the question. So in terms of the bill, what we really started from was building upon the structure of the unemployment insurance model that we currently have. And that was really intentional because the unemployment insurance model is a longstanding one within Minnesota. And we have also had the opportunity to have some lessons learned from other states that have developed programs as well. And so we've taken some lessons learned from other states and are really building upon the unemployment insurance structure to help build out the program. And Ms. Fitzpatrick may have more to add to that as well, Madam Chair, if you'd like to recognize her.
Ms. Fitzpatrick, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Becker-Finn. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I'm the Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. In a prior position at the University of Minnesota, I led the research team that conducted Minnesota's design and implementation study. Representative Scott, could you reference what section you're referring to?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe it's section 14. Section 14.
Okay, Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this section relates to the employment protections. And I think part of the waiving of the rights is just around preserving the rights of workers in that situation to not give away their rights under the bill in this particular section of law, but perhaps attorneys that are here could speak more to that.
I'm not sure who I know Chair Richardson is an attorney, but I'm not sure who else may be prepared to answer that question.
Madam Chair, this is Martha James from House Research.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I can't speak for the author, but I believe that the waiver language, part of the reason may be because, again, this is built on the UI system. And so a claim for benefits is against the account, the fund, and not against the employer. So someone would submit a claim, and that would be paid from the fund that will be funded by the premiums. And so, in other words, the employer wouldn't have the ability to waive this payment of benefits or to agree to a different payment of benefits because it's going through the new system and the new fund.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I guess I can see where that might make sense, but I understand, you wanted to pattern this bill after something that's already existing, but
this is an apples and oranges sort of a comparison, in my opinion. I understand they're paying into an account and all that, but especially when you're introducing a new law like this that is so confusing, my concern is that especially private or smaller employers, they're not going to be able to afford an attorney to wade through this with them, and they're going to probably make mistakes. And so then are they going to be sued? There's not going to be any way to just deal, you know, face-to-face with the employee when something, you know, isn't exactly as this law might be written. I think this is like kind of a hammer approach when some of this stuff could be handled between the employer and the employee face-to-face. And so I have concerns with that. I also have concerns with the fact that, you know, your health and your health records and other things, your employer has access to those. That's troubling to me. I think the damages and stuff, I think, are out of whack. I just think this bill needs a lot of work, and I won't be voting for it today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And I apologize. I missed one of our public testifiers who did come this evening to testify. So we're going to go to her right now. Katie Kramer, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, members of the committee. I'm Katie Kramer, Policy Director of Violence-Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse. We're a statewide coalition with over 90 member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victim survivors in all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I'm testifying in support of HF 1200, the Paid Family Medical Leave Act, and to highlight the need for safety leave protections for survivors of domestic abuse. Whether a survivor is in an abusive relationship, in the midst of fleeing, or working to move forward from a past relationship that was abusive, they are faced with dangers and challenges on many levels. Surviving abuse and navigating its aftermath is traumatic, expensive, and time-consuming. Survivors need time to address their medical and safety needs, such as accessing healthcare, attending counseling, obtaining legal services, meeting with an advocate, or relocating their housing. Yet when survivors take these steps to protect and care for themselves and their children, they often run the risk of losing their employment or much-needed wages as a result of missing work. A member program in Greater Minnesota noted that, quote, a survivor we worked with lost her job recently because she chose to go to the order for protection hearing she needed in order to keep herself and her kids safe, even though her job would not work with her. Now her ability to remain in her house is in jeopardy, and the spiral will continue after that, end quote. And unfortunately, we know that this is not a unique situation. For a survivor in an already tenuous situation, the additional factor of lost income can be devastating, potentially forcing them to face housing loss or returning to an abusive situation. HF 1200 establishes vital supports for survivors of domestic abuse and their children and puts in place much-needed safeguards by creating paid time off for safety leave. Paid safety leave provides survivors with the employment security and financial protection they need to address the health and safety needs of themselves and their children. We urge you to pass this much needed legislation as a step towards ensuring stability for survivors. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer, for highlighting the importance of that piece of the bill. I know in my work working with survivors that it is incredibly time consuming to make it through and take the extra steps, especially when somebody's trying to leave an abuser. So thank you for bringing that up. Representative Richardson, did you have any response to Representative Scott?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for your questions and for your comments as well. You know, I would just say that right now, businesses have access to sensitive data. And when it comes to, for those that are under FMLA, for example, medical certifications are something that they have to deal with right now. And even if FMLA doesn't apply to the employer, you know, situations under the Americans with Disabilities Act require that there be an interactive process and medical information be shared. So businesses have to understand how to deal with sensitive medical information. And the Department of Labor has also put together some great tools and resources for businesses as well from a compliance perspective and around also protecting data as well. And so there are definitely resources out there to help support businesses because with or without this bill, businesses are going to continue to have access to sensitive data.
Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Richardson. I'm going through this bill into almost like a manifesto trying to figure it out. What I'm going through it and trying to find some things, there's a lot of sensitive data that's going to be shared and passed along and people are going to be looking at. Is there any audit trails or anything like that to make sure that when people look it up, there's a justifiable reason for there to be looking at this data?
You beat Representative Scott to the audit trails question. Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for the question. So in terms of the way that the data would be collected within businesses, there is definitely structures and compliance sort of protocols that need to be followed from an employer perspective in order to keep the information safe and private. And in fact, this information should not be kept within an individual's HR file, for example. It should be kept separately. From an auditing perspective, there are auditing requirements, just like we currently have under the unemployment structure, that would require that businesses would comply with any auditing requests and that they would retain that data for at least 4 years. So in terms of the audit structure, it would follow the same process that we currently have with our longstanding UI system.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Richardson. I'm talking about the data the state's collecting. The employers I know, they keep that data very well. I'm more concerned about the data the state is keeping. Who's looking at it? Who's getting access to that? That to me is more concern. And unfortunately, you didn't answer that question. The other concern I have that I was looking at in the penalties if a business is struggling, they're having trouble making those payments. If they make a mistake, you're looking at being 12 and 15% interest compounded yearly on the penalty, which is outrageous. 1% a month? That's 12% a year, and you compound that, you're pushing close to 15% compounded interest. That'll wipe out the small businesses across this state. It's a lot of business that you put something like this and won't even come to the state of Minnesota. I just read an article right now that across on the nation, there's over 600,000 more unemployed than expected. And something like this bill with some of the stuff in here, it's going to keep businesses out of Minnesota. Right now we have we did have at one time the most Fortune 500 companies, but unfortunately they're leaving. And it's stuff like this that's making it difficult for businesses, large businesses, to come to Minnesota. And it's even harder for small businesses to get started. And with that, I cannot support this bill.
Any response, Chair Richardson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for your comments. And I would just remind members that when we're thinking about the sensitive data piece, right now, DEED collects sensitive data right now around unemployment insurance as well. So that's a process that is already in place. The other piece in terms of what we're looking at from the penalties piece, that is what is in place right now within Minnesota as well as it relates to unemployment insurance. So that is something that businesses here right now within the state are facing as well right now. I would also just add that within the COVID pandemic, we've seen a lot of the challenges that businesses have had. And there's been a lot to support businesses in the last 12 months. And this is also an opportunity to ensure that we are supporting the people who power businesses as well, so that they're extended a safety net.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. And I will just share one story that I recently heard of in the area where I grew up in Bemidji, where the Bridges Pub in Bemidji had not previously offered different benefits to their employees, but through the process of the last year had recognized how important their employees are to the long-term success of their business and had recently increased wages and started offering retirement benefits and other benefits to their employees and recognizing how important it was that they were going to be successful even in a small town. So thank you, Chair Richardson. Next on the list is Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I just like the idea of unemployment system that we have right now. I interact with the system a bit during this pandemic. Employers.
Representative Frazier, your audio is breaking. Yeah, if you want to turn off your video and maybe we could try that. Or I can go to Representative Feist if you want to move to a different part of your house. All right, we're going to move on to Representative Feist. We'll come back to you, Representative Frazier. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hopefully my internet works. I just wanted to weigh in as a small business owner. I have 9 employees, and I've definitely had to deal with unemployment insurance and employment law and just all of the things that go into employing people. And I just feel like as a business owner, like I reap the reward of being the business owner. I'm really grateful for the employees that I have. And as a result, I'm able to be a profitable business, and that has served me very well. And I feel like this bill strikes the right balance. And I believe that the employees who work for me deserve to have the safety net. And I'm not intimidated by these extra regulations and protections and expenses. I feel like that's just what you do as a business owner. You deal with regulations. You deal with the laws that govern, you know, being a business owner in the state of Minnesota. And I have been very successful in the last 10 years. And I believe that's in part because I am in a state that is hospitable to business owners. And I just really support this bill. And I would like to see it implemented. And I believe that it will be beneficial for my employees and ultimately for me as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And we got a message from Representative Frazier that he's continuing to have some connectivity issues. So I didn't forget him, but he said it was okay to move on. Members, any further discussion to the bill? All right. Chair Richardson, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present today, and I appreciate the member questions and discussion as well. We have an opportunity to be able to ensure that we're extending a safety net that ensures that everyone has the opportunity to care for themselves, to care for a new child, or to care for a family member who may be ill, because we know at some point it happens to all of us. And so thank you for the opportunity to present today and just ask for members' support.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1200 be recommended to be re-referred to the Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
There are 10 ayes and 7 nays.
With that, the motion prevails, and House File 1200 is on its way to the Workforce and Business Development Committee. Thank you, Chair Richardson, and testifiers. I guess we didn't have quite as many testifiers as usual, but thank you, Madam Chair. With that, we will move on to Representative Hollins is having a very busy day today. We will move on to House File 2245. Representative Hollins, would you like to move your bill be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
Very good. Representative Hollins, your bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. This is a really quick one. This is a bill that would extend the sunset of a 2020 session law that created a temporary filing process needed because of the closure of county offices due to COVID-19. It was Xcel Energy that requested an extension of the sunset because the county offices were operating remotely, and they have asked for an extension of that because the county offices are still operating remotely. I do have a testifier here to speak on this, and she says she's cutting it down to 50 seconds of testimony. So I believe Grania is available.
Yes. Grania, I know, is no stranger to the legislature. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members, and Representative Hollins. Representative Hollins really captured the short story that this is. We appreciate your consideration. It would enable us to proceed next month with a bond issue for $740 million to invest in Minnesota. So thank you for your consideration.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions regarding House File 2245? All right, Representative Hollins, any closing words?
No, thank you for hearing this tonight. I know it's been a long day. I would urge you to support this. There's only good that can come out of it. And I would like to renew my motion.
All right, thank you, Representative Hollins. Yes, I feel like people's internet is starting to rebel as well in this very long day. So appreciate the brevity and keeping to the point. With that, Representative Hollins renews her motion. The House File 2245 be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
He's still not with us.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Collins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny. Representative Novotny. Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Frazier. Representative Novotny. There are 15 ayes and no nays.
All right, the motion prevails and House File 2245 is on its way to the General Register. Members, we're on our final bill of the night, another Representative Hollins bill, House File 856. Representative Hollins, would you like to move your bill to be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is my motion.
All right, and I believe you have an author's amendment. Is that correct? Would you like to move the A4 author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to move that author's amendment.
And then if you could tell us real briefly, Representative Hollins, what the author's amendment does.
Absolutely. This author's amendment just tightens up the language regarding the fiscal matters for the neuropsychological examinations, and it ensures that the cost is going to the Supreme Court, which is the fiscal grantee for the lower district courts.
All right, thank you, Representative Hollins. Any discussion to the A4 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hollins, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for hearing me. This is a bill that would help to prevent and break the cycle of incarceration for people with traumatic brain injury, strokes, or fetal alcohol syndrome who find themselves caught in the criminal justice system. This is a bill that previously Representative Munson had worked on and has continued to support going forward. And I believe the Public Safety Committee has passed this fairly unanimously, as I recall. I have two testifiers with me today to give brief remarks. Jeff Nachbar with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance will give some background on the language. And then we have testimony from Mr. Tim Berry, who has been fighting this battle for his daughter, Cassie, who is currently incarcerated.
All right, very good. We'll move on to the testifiers. Mr. Nachbar, if you could introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nachbar. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance. It's been quite a day. I just have a couple of comments that I'd like to make, and then stand by for questions as well. As Representative Hollins mentioned, this bill, we're attempting to break the cycle of incarceration in the criminal justice system for people with brain injury, stroke, and fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. So the bill asks for neuropsychological examinations to be conducted and considered prior to sentencing in cases of brain injury, stroke, and fetal alcohol syndrome in felony level cases or higher. What we're trying to do is sort of balance the cost with those that are the most impacted on this, get the biggest bang for our buck, and help the most vulnerable at the same time. So those at the greatest risk in the system, and make sure that we're taking that into consideration and they're not falling through the cracks. And those that are in the criminal justice system truly belong, you know, need to be there. This is not a get out of jail free card. Like I'm saying, we're just making sure that this is taken into consideration. We've worked on this bill for a while over the last few years. I know many of you have heard us talk about it or have seen the presentations. And so, you know, just to be clear, we're not looking for an unfunded mandate on the counties. We're looking for a way to balance these costs and make sure that they are adequately paid for in terms of how much they cost and when and how they'll be done. I could give you some background on how the bill has traveled in the pathway, but I won't take your time tonight to do that. Essentially, you know, there are some costs associated with it, and how do we balance that against the long-term costs of a lifetime of incarceration? So even though it might cost a little bit up front to do these neuropsych evaluations, although it might cost a little bit short-term to consider some alternative approaches, we know that a lifetime of incarceration is not cheap, and the challenge, of course, with the fiscal notes in the system and the budget is to try to capture those savings. So those are the points I just wanted to make about the bill. I have a lot of passion and other things I'd love to say, and I won't, but I'll be happy to stand by if anybody has any questions, because I know you're probably more interested in hearing from a constituent who's taking the day off today to make sure that you guys understand how this affects him. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Now we'll move on to Mr. Berry. If you could introduce yourself for the record, and then please do go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Berry. I am from Burgess, Minnesota. And first off, I would like you to see, this is my daughter, Cassandra. This is who we're talking about. She presently sits in a Shakopee women's prison right now. It is a source of great complaint with sheriffs and jailers that they must receive such persons because they have found no suitable accommodations for them, wrote minister turned prison reformer, Reverend Louis Dwight. Mr. Dwight wrote that in 1820. We've been doing this for over 200 years. The treatment of the mentally ill in our state in and of itself is a crime. This from a sergeant at the Crow Wing County Jail. The Department of Human Services just slams the door on us. This from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Tim, your daughter is the poster child for a broken system. That from a Department of Human Services employee. Representative Jack Considine, when he was there last year, went out to the prison to visit my daughter. He came back from that prison and he says, Tim, why is your daughter in prison? Commissioner Paul Schnell, I've been talking to him over the last couple of years. He went out and visited my daughter. He also came back. Mr. Schnell asked me, Tim, why is your daughter in my prison? He could not believe it. What is a father to do after hearing these things from a system which I thought was designed to protect the vulnerable in our society? These are just a few of the things I've heard over the last 7 years trying to get my daughter Cassie help in our state. My walk from Clay County Courthouse to the Capitol in April 2018 accomplished nothing more than to get me two pant sizes smaller. That has led me to this point. Cassie's story, in short, bipolar at 15, which turned into addiction because of self-medication, self-medicating or bipolar. At age 26, had a massive frontal lobe stroke, along with an amputation of her right leg due to the stroke. Since that time, I have been trying to get Cassie help wherever possible. Basically, the only place she has been is prison and jail and maybe a treatment center. She's been to drug and alcohol treatment, and she's not been to a stroke rehabilitation, which is what she really needs. While in prison, she received her prosthetic leg and was beginning to walk 3 years ago. The inmate stole the remote control to her leg and flushed it down the toilet, leaving her leg inoperable. The prison sent her leg to Essentia Health in Fargo to be repaired. Essentia Health repossessed Cassie's leg for non-payment because while you're incarcerated, Social Security disability does not cover. She has lost her leg twice. What psychological damage did that do along with the stroke and the bipolar? When she's in jail and prison because of her brain damage and lack of impulse control due to the stroke, she spends most of her time in solitary confinement. What further damage does that do? Cassie just got out of solitary confinement yesterday. She called me. She just got out of solitary again after another 60 days in solitary segregation. This is but a minuscule part of Cassie's story, and I'm sure just one that could be told by families across the state. From my perspective, if an individual treated a vulnerable adult or mentally ill person the way the state treats them, they themselves would be in jail. Time has come for criminal justice and human service reform in our state so people and families can get the help they need and stop the suffering. This is from a policy paper, 2016-17. Decriminalization of mental illness, fixing a broken system, put out by the Conference of State Supreme Court Administrators, would be an excellent start. When mental illness is a factor in lawlessness, and that fact is ignored, the result can be unproductive recycling of the perpetrator through the criminal justice system, with dire consequences to us all. This is a neuropsychological exam that I had got from my daughter 3 years ago. The doctor's opinion, Cassandra does have mental deficiencies from her stroke, but also from her history of seizure, migraine headaches, multiple concussive episodes, polysubstance abuse, and PTSD. Treatment to the best of my ability to determine has not been consistently applied to this individual for many reasons. But nonetheless, there are treatments that could attempt to assist Cassandra to develop more control over her life. Cassandra basically is experiencing the late effects of a right hemisphere stroke that are superimposed on the pre-existing problems described above. Nonetheless, there are many behaviors that could be amenable to appropriate stroke rehabilitation. This is what a judge needs to use. This is what a judge needs to hear. I got this done and it was worthless because the judge could not take it into account when he was sentencing my daughter. The only avenue that judge had was to put my daughter in prison where she sits in solitary confinement most of the time because of her lack of impulse control, no sense of consequence, and the effects of the TBI. So I would like to ask for your support in House File 856 Committee. And Madam Chair, I appreciate your time. I know it's been a long day for you, and I appreciate your support. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mr. Berry, and thank you for sharing your story and your daughter's story. I really appreciate that Representative Hollins has been an advocate for this bill and making sure that it gets heard this year. We will move on to member discussion. I will note, however, we do need to wrap up in not very many minutes. So Representative Mortensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Hollins for bringing this bill forward. As a representative out of Shakopee, I've spoken to Mr. Berry. I reached out to the warden of the Shakopee Women's Penitentiary. And in my conversations with the warden, it sounds like she's on the same page as a lot of the testimony of Mr. Berry, that this is not the right place for Cassie. I'm a little disappointed this is going to get put into an omnibus bill, but I appreciate the bill coming forward and getting heard.
Thank you, Representative Mortensen. We do not have the fiscal note yet, so we will not be able to move it forward until we know what the cost would be. That's just how it works when something costs some money. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Holland, I understand this bill very well. I've heard it numerous times. The biggest issue with this bill is this should be done in the Rule 20 pre-trial. Unfortunately for Mr. Berry, the TBI occurred after conviction of his daughter, and that's one of the problems. She had other issues before that because of the narcotics use that she did. I've also talked to Commissioner Schnell. She's been placed a few times in outside of the prison. Unfortunately, because of her condition, there is no place in the state anymore that we can actually put her. Because of her condition, it makes it very difficult. No place will take her. I wish I could send a better light. I wish we could do something for your daughter and for others, but this needs to be taken at pre-conviction or in the Rule 20 hearing before the trial starts. Because when the trial goes, the Rule 20 decides if they're capable of standing trial and not afterwards. This is doing a Rule 20 after conviction. If it was post-trial, I would support it. But pre-trial, I would support it. Post-trial, I cannot, even though And that information should be done pre-trial, so the pre-sentence investigation could actually look at it. If there even is a trial because of the injury caused the lack of ability to understand what they were doing, and then there would never be a trial. And I really grieve for you, Mr. Berry. You're in a tough situation. But like I say, this has to be pre-trial and not post-trial. Otherwise, we'll be doing two Rule 20 hearings at the same time. So I'm sorry about that. So thank you.
And I'll just remind members that although Mr. Berry has shared a very personal story, this bill would impact more than just one person. And I certainly appreciate hearing his story and sharing Cassie's story as well. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to point out that a judge, when sentencing, can take into account mitigating factors, and the sentencing guidelines do list lacking substantial capacity as a mitigating factor. So I think the information based on this bill and that neuropsychological examination would be really useful if the judge is considering mitigating factors at sentencing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Moeller and Representative Hollins.
Sorry, I just want to add one final thing. I completely understand Representative Johnson's point. I will say that Rule 20 is a different standard, and to be found competent to stand trial is very different than having impulse control issues from a traumatic brain injury or stroke. And so what we would see, I think, in a lot of times is somebody could be competent to stand trial, but also be found to have these mitigating circumstances in which it would be appropriate. Now, Representative Johnson, I 100% agree with you. I would love to see this be handled before we get to trial, but really that's cost prohibitive in a lot of circumstances. And I think that's the reason why we chose to go with the pre-sentence investigation as opposed to prior to the trial itself.
And with that, members, we are out of time with our time slot today. Representative Hollins, I've got like 30 seconds if you want to close, and just a reminder that we're laying this bill over.
I just want to thank Mr. Berry for sticking with us this entire day. He was ready to testify this morning, and I think I'm just, you know, endlessly grateful for his strong leadership on this, and really grateful for the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance and their help.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hollins, and thank you, Mr. Berry, for bearing with us in our very long legislative day today, but it was very important to hear from you and to hear Cassie's story, so thank you very much. With that, House File 856, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill. We will see you in approximately 12 hours. Be well, members. And with that, we are adjourned.